Park Place Meeting, Saturday morning, 19th June 1976. We have been considering the discipline of the senses. By this sort of discipline, the senses function more and more freely until, in the fruitive stages, all the senses are in perfect activity. We also saw how, when the senses function like this, our isolative consciousness loses its isolativeness. That is to say, it's no loss, it's a gain, in fact. One becomes free of limitation, of separation. And the state of compassion, of true love prevails. Now, as and when that happens, consider what happens in relation to what we call evil things. If the state of true love prevails, love by being love, what room is there for malevolence or ill will or anger or hate, above all for any sort of rejection? Now, this is a point of supreme importance in practical affairs all over the world. If some disharmony arises in relationship between two people or two societies or nations or whatever it may be, if there is no sense of rejection, then the two can consider together in the right spirit and in the right way the situation which may in some way or other have gone wrong. And in that considering together, it is almost bound to come right, because with the presence of true love as the inspiring dynamic behind it all, the healing dynamic behind it all, and because of the fact that the purified senses see, hear truly, then once again complete harmony, real harmony, can come into being. Otherwise, the sort of agreement or arrangement one makes is always in terms of containing hidden forces, if not obvious forces, for disruption again. You see, this is why all the peace treaties of the world sooner or later prove futile. They are founded on self-interest. And self-interest involves rejection of that which does not conduce to one's own self-interest. In that state of rejection, the wholeness is lost. And if the wholeness is lost, the health the harmony is lost and illness is actually present. This is why, in our own family life, for instance, it is so difficult to live naturally and spontaneously, unknowingly, as a whole family. Things get wrong. Then we want to put it right. But what sort of a person am I trying to put it right? I'm a person who within himself has the seeds of disruption present all the time. So is the other person, unless he or she happens to be a holy one. See, the tremendous consequence of even the first step on the path, just to train the senses to function rightly. We see now malevolence has disappeared. If we see and hear and so on wholly, what happens to our natural possessiveness, our aggressiveness? Aggressiveness is self-assertion, egoistic self-assertion, at the expense of others. Possessiveness is also a manifestation of separativeness. All these naturally fade away out of the living organism. Now, I've used that phrase very deliberately. They fade away naturally. Now, you see what a difference this is. How different this is from the usual approach of attacking the evil, of getting rid of the evil, and so on. You can't do it. Because this evil is the disease, the diseased expression of my own psychical energy. It is part of my living being. If I were to try to get rid of it in a fashion analogous to the surgeon who has to perform a physical operation and cut out some organ or something inside the body, well, that is gone forever, so to say. Now, in the case of the psyche, in the first instance, it just can't be done, because the psyche is a whole thing. There is no special organ which functions malevolently, a special organ which functions generously or kindly in the psyche. The psyche is not in bits. It's the functioning of the whole organism. And the whole psyche is in that state at once. So people sometimes say, oh, but I feel love and hate together. You don't. This is a misconception. The incapacity to see that whilst the feeling, the emotion of love and hate may alternate very swiftly, nevertheless, it alternates. The whole psyche at one split second is loving, the whole psyche is the other thing the next split second, and so on. That is possible. But it is never a case of any particular organ or a set of organs inside the psyche, like we have a set of organs inside the body, which perform specific and distinct functions. We forget this, you see. So now, possessiveness disappears. Greed, lust, all those things are bound to disappear. Lust, in its really evil sense, is the aggressive imposition of one's passion to obtain gratification, some sort of sensational gratification, whether it be the lust for possessions or ordinary sexual lust, or whether it be the lust for attaining high-sounding goals and ambitions and all the rest of it. It is all lust, including the lust for transcendence, the lust for God. Now, why is that a lust? It sounds absolutely astonishing that people, quite genuine, honest, sincere people, have this lust for God. Why is that a lust? If you look sufficiently deeply, you will find that this God whom one is craving for, this is the important point, this God whom one is craving for is the God of my own creation, my own misconception, my own thought form. And my own thought form is a dark, solid, opaque obstruction between the reality which is God and the reality which is me. And remember, the reality which is God, the totality, and the reality which is me, the microcosm, is one whole reality, one total reality. The separateness is in the deficiency of my mode of awareness. You have, all of you have heard me say several times, the whole story of spiritual development, of religious fulfillment, and therefore of the full, true fruition of us as human beings, it is a story of the transformation of one's mode of awareness. See, you become aware, you become conscious of existence in a totally different manner. Nothing gets rejected. Everything is included. You don't have to make any deliberate effort to include. It is natural to you to be inclusive in mind and consciousness. Now you see, if I am inclusive in mind and consciousness, then I don't have to acquire or develop the virtue of love. All acquisition, all such desired development, has the conditioned mind at work, busily making a picture of that which it wants to acquire. And all the mind pictures of that nature, the mind, this separate mind functioning in its limited sense, you see, they are always short of the total reality, and they are always faulty. So, don't make any pictures. Be utterly free. Let be. Life in its immensity, in its unthinkable grace and beauty, does everything. And you see, in that, with that kind of approach and that state, you grow happily. This is a curious kind of happiness. It includes all pain and all sorrow. And it includes all pain and sorrow in such a manner that you don't try to convert the pain and the sorrow. You let it work. Because in mysterious ways, when you let pain and sorrow work within yourself, a spiritual alchemy proceeds. An alchemy of complete transmutation. It is true that in the ordinary everyday life, this kind of transmutation doesn't last forever, as we call it. Because situations arise which inevitably produce pain and sorrow. An earthquake takes place. A flood. I mean, nowadays, almost every day in the news, all over the world, we hear of horrible, painful, sorrowful, tragic things happening. Mankind suffering, the animal world suffering, the plant world suffering. Through mankind's ignorance, greed, destructiveness, all for himself. We hear, you and I as individuals hear all these things, and we naturally feel the pain and the sorrow of it. Now, how do we respond to that feeling? Consider how we get overwhelmed, we get upset, we rush about making everybody else aware. Look, do you know what's happening here and how awful, how terrible? Now, if I get into that state, am I contributing to the peace and harmony of the world, or am I adding to its disturbance? I myself, I'm adding another little disturbance because my own psyche is disturbed. But if inwardly I remain poised and my senses function utterly pure, I will sensitively respond. I will be immeasurably more sensitive to the nature of the horrible things that there are. But when I am not upset, then I am a source of healing. Because if one's own psyche is pure and calm and poised, it cannot harm the world. You are in a harmless state. So you see, this very first step of the training of the senses has all kinds of consequences. Now, in such a state, with the state of true love prevailing within one's own being, when impressions come to us from the world, from the outer world, and of course the whole of the outer world is constantly pouring in a flood of stimuli upon us, and we get impressions. In that state of love and the capacity to absorb it all, one naturally sees things truly as they are, because in that state of love our particular prejudices and so forth, which are all the result of self-orientation, are no longer at play. This way, understanding grows. The pure intelligence which inherently constitutes you, constitutes what is the mind, what we call the mind. This pure intelligence grows as a faculty, as a power for seeing truly all the time. So now, whilst I talked of the transmutative, transformative activity that goes on inside, because one is quiet and there is this state of love. With this transmutative activity, the mind becomes the perfect instrument of the functioning of intelligence. I'm using the word mind in the limited sense here, especially as manifested in terms of your psyche. I think I ought to explain, and you'll also find it definitely explained in the book. The psyche I distinguish from mind in this way. You know that Buddhism presents one marvelous meaning of its phrase, nama rupa. Instead of talking of all this as body and mind, it talks in terms of corporeality mentality. Yes, to sit down there. Corporeality mentality. Now you see the tremendous advantage of looking at things that way. Instead of saying my body, my mind, to see the to have in your own perception the idea of corporeality mentality, you get the universal feel of it all. Out of the universal matter, the solids, liquids, gases composing the body emerge. They are not mind specifically. They are just the universal stuff. Similarly, with what I call my thoughts, my feelings, and so forth, they are not my thoughts, my feelings. You watch carefully. How does a feeling emerge in you? How does a thought uprise in you? It is the resultant of so many thoughts and ideas and beliefs and conceptions at work. And in the immediate living now, these forces at play produce this thought, this feeling and that feeling, and so on. You see? Again, by this means, one becomes free of this isolative consciousness, this separative, limiting, restricting perception of things. So, when all this happens, when pure intelligence functions in its own right as pure as a capacity, then what is called wisdom comes into play. Because the pure intelligence is indefinable. It has no limitations. It doesn't see just within a limited context in a limited manner. It sees, it perceives what is apparently the limited, ensconced in the background of the totality. And the totality is pure mind. Now this pure mind, I should have said this before explaining psyche and mind, this total mind interacting with corporeality manifested in your body, and especially your brain, the ductless glands, and so on. produces your particular type of mental functioning, your basic type of mental functioning. And that is what I call your psyche. You might say this is very arbitrary. Yes, of course, it is. I have said it. This is the way I present it, because I have found it useful and it helps to understand. So the psyche is definitely yours. The mind is universal. And it is my psychophysical functioning which makes manifest what appears to be and is commonly called my mind. If one really understands this and then doesn't sort of put it on a mental shelf somewhere, but is awake and mindful and functions all the time this way, then the mind knows, realizes its purification. It gets free of its biases and prejudices and so on. Then it makes no assumptions, because in terms of that sustaining, enlightening, enriching background of the total universal mind, there is no room for assumptions and preconceptions. Conceptions and specific conceptions must of necessity arise. They arise because it is the nature of the psychophysical organism to throw out ideas and conceptions. That which you are aware of when requiring expressions for the sake of communication throws out ideas and concepts and so forth. Those ideas and concepts may be helpful to someone else, helpful by virtue of stimulating that person's own mental activity. That is all. But if one throws out ideas and concepts and the other person receives particular ideas and concepts with the mistaken attitude of, this is the truth, then there is only further bondage. You've jumped from one pit into another pit. You see? And how long, unfortunately, has mankind done this pit jumping business? Through the ages. You see? And when I am in one pit, the pit is a limited thing. And I say, oh no, that other pit is not a good pit, you know, this is a better pit. and whatever comes out of that pit is bad or to be got rid of or some such thing. So, man never lives in harmony. Now, we, for instance, here, gathered here, in a state of communion, in a state of where love and beauty naturally prevail, when we receive the impact of the everyday world, when we go back to the city and do big business or little business or fine work or shady things or whatever they are, you see. Back again, we are caught up in that atmosphere. What is our problem in that atmosphere? Of course, it is a disruptive and a troublesome atmosphere. But if we have awakened to any extent, which of course is determined by the fact that we use our senses rightly to start with. If we have awakened to that extent and can maintain the awake state, then we suffer all the ill effects around us, because no one can prevent breathing in whatever air there is available, and if it is polluted with foul gases and the oxides of sulfur and nitrogen and so forth, from belching from factories and all the rest of it. Just as you can't avoid that, you can't avoid taking that into yourself. But if your mode of awareness of existence remains firm and constant, powerful, in terms of the wholeness, in terms of completeness, then the power of compassion and of wisdom and goodness, purity, goes out from you. The organism has to be fit enough to stand that strain. Now, this is one of the ways in which the discipline of yoga, including especially the asanas and pranayama, comes into play. It is a powerful help, but it will not be a powerful help, it will be the opposite, if one is not awake to this wholeness at the same time. If one's mode of awareness is a self-oriented mode, then any such discipline which intensifies your sensitivities and also releases the power of remaining wholly poised within yourself, if you will let it, provided there is the whole attitude towards everything, then everything is all right. Then the presence of the yogi is a benediction, is a harmonizing power. Right. So now, when you see malevolence, ill will, greed disappear, and also you will find your illusions disappearing, and they'll disappear happily. How do our illusions normally disappear? Painfully. Disillusionment and the distress caused by it. I know from my own experience, when finally, a few years ago, 10, 12 years ago, I saw quite clearly that the popular pictures and presentations of doctrines like rebirth and karma were misleading presentations of a profound reality. When I saw that and finally got free of it, I got free of the immense intellectual distress that I went through for quite 30 years. As a child, I had swallowed all these doctrines, lock, stock and barrel, exactly as presented. Why? How? Well, in the state of ignorance, one naturally does that, you see. But when you begin to wake up to the fact that these are mental constructs making pictures of an underlying reality, and that the constructs in themselves can be and almost always are faulty, because one tends to fixate the construct, this which has been said is the whole truth, you see, then you never grow in pure intelligence and perception. And to discover that the particular form in which these things were presented, bit by bit I began to discover it. I should say from about 1928 or 9 onwards, from somewhere there, It caused inner conflict. And it grew and it grew and it grew. I did the usual things, played ostrich, turned my head away and buried it in the sand. But no, what is the truth? The truth is something which is expressed in an inadequate form here, and a misleading form. Then finally, you are prepared to let go of the form. We grasp the form, we have intellectual greed, we have fear right inside us. If I let this go, I have nothing to lean upon, I have nothing to support me, nothing to sustain me, which is all nonsensical. You are not supported by these external shells. Your support is the transcendent within your own being. You are transcendence embodied. And it is, I'm putting it in this form, again, it's a mental construct, so don't hold on to the construct, but try and get the reality. Transcendence will not force you to grow. Its benediction pours upon you. Its grace is always within you. And because you yourself obstruct it out of fear, out of the desire to be comfortable, not to have your ideas, your beliefs shaken and so forth, you are caught in illusions and delusions. But keep open, keep wide awake, and you will find that you live by virtue of life, the unknown, the immeasurable, the marvelous, and the extraordinary freedom and liberation that will burst out of your being, and you breathe freely. The great pranayama. You see? So, the discipline, learning by growing happily, proceeds in this way. Now you see, how utterly different this is from carrying out a laid down procedure. Conformity, strict conformity to a laid down pattern. Patterns must of necessity get laid down if we are to talk at all, if we are to write at all. Because the truth in itself is not conveyable. It is there all the time. You are the truth, you are the way, you are the life. You are everything that is the absolute, the immortal, the eternal. That which utterly transcends all limitation and everything. You are all that, you see. But if you just conform to the patterns which are raised up, then what are you doing? You're just putting some paint and powder over a pimple or a sore or whatever it is. But you're suffering from the pimple all the time. You see? I'm trying hard, and I have to try this week. I have to try hard because, as you know, I'm not absolutely in the prime of my vigor just at present. To make you aware of the nature of discipline, this learning by growing happily, of the nature of that which is growing or trying to grow, and of the nature of that towards which the growth is taking place. You see? So, find your release from all the set forms, from conformity to fix any sort of fixation. Which of us, with rare exceptions in the world, which of us is prepared to stay put with conformity as manifested in his physical circumstances and his physical life. I've got a small cottage, but the toilet is outside. The kitchen is in such a place that there isn't the right sort of window for light to come in, all sorts of things. You are dissatisfied with it. You don't just say, I'll stay put and conform just to this little pattern for the rest of my days for the next 500 years. You don't. You want to improve it. You want to better it, you see. But in which way do you want to better it? You want to better it in order that it may suit your likes, your own ideas, your aesthetic sense, and of course the practical things involved. What makes the whole house more efficient and so on. All right. As far as pure efficiency is concerned, it is unself-oriented. It's not oriented to the self. It's just pure efficiency. But where likes and dislikes are concerned, there is a self-orientation. Because involved with those likes and dislikes are little factors of egoism and vanity. When Mrs. Jones comes along to visit you, you can show her your kitchen because you know hers isn't quite so good. Now, so in physical life, we don't want to be tied down to conformity. It's the same with our mental life. It's the same with our spiritual life. It's the same with the deep things which we call faith and so forth. So you grow from within. Growth takes place from within. Involved with that is the response to the stimuli from without. And in order that this interaction may be of the right sort, the discipline of the senses leading to the freeing of the heart, the establishment of the state, the natural emergence of the state of pure love, and the natural emergence of this intelligence, this pure intelligence, which sees the truth of things as they are. They all come into being and they all help. See, the holy life, the pure life, is the happy life. You will not find any happiness in the real sense, anything comparable to the living of the holy life, the living of the religious life. And that is why the living of the religious life is truly the living of the human life. Again and again we have considered this, the meaning of the word human, the happy creator. What is creation? Can you define it? Can you put it on a platter? You can't. You see? The happy creator. Now there is one very remarkable thing which happens in connection with this. As one grows in this manner, and your mode of awareness of existence undergoes this change, it is associated with, right from the start, and comes to its culmination in terms of perfect attentiveness. The truly awakened state is the perfectly attentive state. In the perfectly attentive state, there is no possibility of grasping at any one thing, either in the name of one's personal self, or in the name of the family or society or the nation or the whole cosmos or God or Brahman or anything. No grasping is possible. in total attentiveness, complete attentiveness, you are living, you are vibrating in tune with the eternal, the immortal, creative pulsation of life. And this creative pulsation of life holds in itself the vibrating between being and non-being. Being is particular, individual, limited, mortal. Non-being is not particular, it's unlimited, it's infinite, it's immortal. You see? That vibration, its amplitude, covers the whole of being and non-being. Therefore, this which we call death, and this which is our root fear, our fundamental fear, the fear of death as annihilation, gets wiped out altogether. Why and how? Because in this type of attentiveness, you are awake to the fact that what is commonly called the life-death pulse is taking place simultaneously every split second. And this which is called death should be called other life. But remember, not other life in the false sense of the continuity of identifiable, limited entity. This is the mistake we make. And this, as far as I'm aware, no theology in the world has ever even tried to present and understand. This pulsation, this creative pulsation, is the pulsation of energy, of transcendent energy. And I use the adjective transcendent so as not to confine it purely to the scientists' teachings about energy. The scientist must of necessity have his particular meaning for energy. But energy is much more in itself than all that. This pulsation of energy is not like, it's obviously being a pulsation, it's not like a river steadily flowing past. It is a discontinuous vibrating. It is non-repetitive as far as that which it produces is concerned. Every single pulse brings forth a totally new creation. Mysteriously, that new creation is the resultant of the previous creation. Now look, I'm talking inadequately. I have no option but to. Because when I said previously, there is time involved. But in this creative pulse, there is no time involved. As far as the material world is concerned, the integrated space-time is involved. But as far as the whole cosmos, what we call the mental or spiritual and everything is concerned, you see, that is something which is quite different. It has no time, no space. For the very simple reason that time and space are categories which are a priori to our mode of consciousness. Our mode of consciousness as we are at this moment functioning. when this purification takes place within the whole being, this whole mode of awareness has undergone transformation. And these categories of space-time vanish. And when the categories of space-time vanish, what we commonly call and conceive of as motion, and motion, the concept of motion must necessarily involve space and time, distance and time taken to traverse the distance, they all disappear. The immediate here now is the totality also. The point is the boundless sphere. The boundless sphere is the point. You, in a curious way, suddenly thrill to that. See? So, there is no repetitiveness. And yet, I can't talk in any other way. The very next creation is the resultant of the previous creation. But not utilizing old material. The material itself, oh, how difficult these words are. They so easily mislead. But I have to use these words. Try and get the feel of it somehow. Get the throb of it. The material itself is utterly new. Now, death is that in between the two pulses. When you are totally attentive, you can't know it. You can't be conscious of it as I, the subject, John Smith, am conscious of this pulse. Now the in-between, now the next pulse. Oh no, it's totally impossible. You see? You can't be conscious of it. But in that pulsation, death is realized as other life. There is no death. This is one of the very deep, profound significances in Christian teaching involved in resurrection and ascension. This is not a specifically Christian teaching. Resurrection and ascension has been known from Egyptian days, from quite 3,000 and 4,000 BC at least. This has been known. In the Upanishads, you find in the Aitareya Upanishad, which is probably the first of the Upanishads to be written, it's the oldest of the Upanishads, it is said very distinctly that the sage, the Holy One, Vamadeva, who was one of the great poet seers of several of the hymns of the Rig Veda, Vamadeva, having said this, ascended aloft by means of the intelligential self, this pure intelligence, and became immortal. Yea, became immortal. So, in this total attentiveness, this ultimate root of fear that the separate self will get annihilated is out. There is no such thing as the separate self. And it is no longer a set of words. It is no longer an intellectual concept, a mental construct, to which one clings and which therefore is a bondage to oneself and restricts oneself. But you see how this thing, death, is the twin of life. These two twins are one, tremendous reality. Immortal. Meaning never born, never proceeding, never dying. You see where the discipline leads to? You see why I said, was it on Wednesday morning that the God conceptions of the world, or Thursday morning, I forget when, that the God conceptions of the world represent, as far as it is possible to express it, the vision through realization, not through wishful thinking or mere idealism, intellectual idealism, but through realization, the vision through realization of what man is emerging into.